got some sayings here. All's well that ends well. A leopard cannot change its spots. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. These are all what are called modern day proverbs that we use these. I say some of these. You probably hear them. You might use some of these. So for the next 9 weeks, we're going to begin a series called Proverbial Sayings. Reasonable? Yeah, that makes sense. Or reckless? I'm not sure if that's the whole truth here. There are all kinds of sayings that we repeat, we hear, we say, and they influence our thinking. They influence us sometimes, I think, more than we even realize. I looked in Wikipedia. You know, we would go to Wikipedia. It's the easiest thing to read. There were like several hundred of these, and I would read through the list. I'm like, I know that one. I use that one. I've heard that one many, many times. A few I didn't know, but it's like there are a lot of sayings that we hear in our culture that are true and are not true. And that's what we're going to be talking about over the next few weeks. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I've never heard a series like this, so I think it's going to be exciting. So, story time. Dawn and I were at a family gathering several months ago. And you know how it is when family, extended family gets together, cousins, I mean, aunts, uncles, all the extended family gets together. And there's a little bit of a history. Sometimes there's a little bit of hard feelings because somebody said so-and-so or a misunderstanding. And there's these underlying feelings sometimes that you try not to really think about, but you just want to get along and smile. But they're sort of there. So there was a particular family member there that has made a lot of mistakes, I would say. It was involved in really hard illicit drugs for many years, abused alcohol for many, many decades, and smoked his whole life, and as a result, has a lot of health problems. Okay, so he knows that he's made mistakes. He's repentant. He's a wonderful person, but he's sort of paying the consequences of some of the mistakes that he's made. And aren't we all? We've all made mistakes, and we all pay the consequences for that. So at this family gathering, we were going to a entertainment venue that required a lot of walking. And this individual, he says, I don't know that I can really walk that far. He was on oxygen part of the time. And we said, that's fine. We understand. If you don't want to go, just, you know, hang out or whatever. Well, I overheard another family member, who this person didn't hear say it, but I heard it, said in sort of a snarky way, well, I don't feel sorry for him. He made his bed and he can just lie in it. And I think I've probably said that before myself, or something to the equivalent of that. You've probably heard that. Here's some other expressions that sort of mean the same thing. He asked for it. That's on him. What's the one you heard? He got what was coming to him. He dug his own grave. This is when I say, what goes around comes around. And there's some truth to that. He brought it on himself. You reap what you sow. He has to face the consequences of his actions. I mean, aren't these all relatively true statements? So he made his bed. He has to line it. That proverb is based on a 15th century French proverb that says, one makes the bed so that he will find it. And we know what it means. It means a man finds himself in situations or consequences that he creates for himself. I mean, that's the way it is. It's just a true statement. And on the surface, it makes a lot of sense. And I find it interesting that we tend to say these phrases about other people more than we say them about ourselves. So at least that's what I found. So this sort of got me to thinking about the word that I use. Sometimes we use it, and it's a very common concept throughout the world, karma. So this is a little crude, but you may have heard karma is a real expletive. Maybe, I hope you don't know what that one is. Karma is real. Karma is inevitable. Karma is a boomerang. I mean, karma is a concept that's considered, you know, true in about 2 billion people on the planet believe in some form of reincarnation. So it's a very prominent way of thinking. It's a fundamental concept in mostly its Eastern spiritual and philosophical traditions, and it's depicted as the law of cause and effect. Every situation has consequences that shapes one's destiny. So another way of saying it is, if we engage in good behavior, good things will happen. Engage in wicked behavior, on the other hand, brings negativity upon us. The result of our behavior is unavoidable. And in other words, we get what we deserve. True? Yes, and maybe not always. Both Hinduism and Buddhism believe in the doctrine of karma, according to which actions have consequences and beings are bound by their desire-ridden actions to the cycle of births and deaths. You may know some Buddhist people. I think Buddhism has some really interesting ways of thinking about things. But we talk about good karma that will be rewarded, not in this life necessarily, but being reincarnated in another life form. And then we've heard of bad karma. Kurt Cobain, you've heard of him. He says, if you're a really mean person, you're going to come back as a fly and eat poop. That's the way he said. So when I was in high school, I worked at a little convenience store. It's like a 7-Eleven, but it was owned by a mom and pop kind of a thing. Mr. and Mrs. Blaylock. I will never forget. It's funny the things that stick with you over time. They were a very nice older couple, and I worked there sweeping and mopping and doing the things that you do in a little convenience store. And one of my jobs is, I think some of you are older like me, but back in the day when you recycled Coke bottles and Pepsi bottles and Fanta bottles, my job was to sort the bottles where they belong, and they'd be picked up and taken back and cleaned and used again. So I remember this very vividly. I was like taking the bottle and putting it into the little crate where it belongs, and a little mouse ran across. Well, let me back up a little bit and tell you this. Mr. and Mrs. Blaylock, in my mind at that time, they were ancient. They were probably 60s or 70s, but I thought they were old. Well, Mr. Blaylock passed away. They were always there in the store. They were always there. So we missed him because he was always there, nice man. Well, his wife, Mrs. Blaylock, she was a little different. And she was a little different. But she was grieving her husband, and she was, of course, thinking about a lot of different things. Well, this is the memory I have. So there was a little mouse that ran by, and I grabbed a broom. I think I heard there was a girl scream. She saw it. I looked. I just remember this. Grabbed the broom, tried to hit the mouse, and Mrs. Blaylock screamed, Jimmy! That was the name I went by. Jimmy, don't do that! I'm like, why? That could be Mr. Blaylock. And I was like, what? I mean, as a teenager, I was rolling my eyes like, oh, okay, whatever, Mrs. Blaylock. She was just, you know, grieving and trying to make sense of the world, and she was off into that. So I said, I'll never forget that particular thing. So what does the Bible have to say about this concept? Well, I think I said earlier that we reap what we sow. I mean, in Galatians 6:7, do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, he will also reap. Which leads to the question, leads to the conclusion, I guess. Natural consequences of one's choices and behaviors our behaviors have consequences. It's just a given. If you have a friend and you're constantly putting that friend down and saying, you know, I don't really like you, you're just not a good person, but you hear it often enough and it's like, oh, I don't want to be your friend anymore. You touch a hot stove, you burn yourself. There are natural consequences to our behaviors. It's just a fact of life. Paul says, whoever sows to please their flesh from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit will reap life. We were singing about a pit. God picked me out of the pit this morning. Proverbs 26 says, whoever digs a pit will fall in it. Cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect. So, maybe we can think in terms of, you remember Venn diagrams when you were in school? little circle here, you got the circle here, and then the little part in the middle. So let's think about karma versus a Christian way of thinking about this whole concept. So before we do that, we know that we do reap the consequences of our behaviors, but for the believer in Jesus, that is not always the end of the story. And why is that? Because of two things. Because of God's mercy and because of a five-letter word that starts with G, God's grace. Because of God's grace, thankfully, we do not always reap what we sow. God reserves the right to show mercy. So if you're mind, if you'll do the little karma on one side and the Christian way of thinking about this concept in the middle, maybe cause and effect. Karma is based on personal merit, performance, and self-effort. Grace is based on God's love and mercy, often independent of human merit. Karma ensures that you get exactly what you deserve. Grace provides what you do not deserve, His mercy and His favor. Karma is impersonal, natural, or cosmic law. Grace is a personal action from a relational God. Karma often leads to a cycle of debt and fear of consequences. Grace offers freedom from debt, of sin, and a new beginning. So, he made his bed, now he can lie in it. It may be true, but in God's economy, or in God's plan for humanity, that's not always the end of the story. Grace has been defined as what? God's unmerited favor. And everybody sitting here, everybody on Zoom, we understand that. I think we all understand it. We have been recipients of God's grace and redemption, and we have a relationship with Him. Anybody here play Spades, the card game named Spades? Okay, do you know if you have a two of spades, will it beat a ace of hearts? Yes, spades trumps all the other suits in this. So grace trumps karma. In karma, there's no hope apart from what we can do for ourselves by our own effort. The Bible teaches us and experience shows us that we are sinful by nature, and left to our own selves, we will do evil and thus deserve punishment. Grace, however, does what we cannot do. It gives us eternal life that we do not deserve and gives us God's Spirit to do good things. So, Psalm 103. He has dealt with us. I'm sorry, let me start this again because I got that totally wrong. He has not dealt with us according to our sins, nor punished us according to our iniquities. Isn't that good news? Let's just think about some biblical accounts and that we know these stories very well, so I'm not going to tell the story because you know the story. Adam and Eve, did they reap what they sowed? Yes, and maybe not completely. So they got thrown out of the garden for their sin. There were thorns and thistles in response to the work. Sweat of the brow. There was, what was it? God was merciful to provide coverings for them. I was going to say, well, actually, I wasn't going to say because I can't really relate to that, Brianna. But for the women in here, there are labor pains. But when you think about it, the bad thing that Adam and Eve did resulted in a woman named Mary, who gave birth to Jesus, the Messiah, who came to right every wrong, right? So we have that truth, that promise, that truth that we hold on to every day. So just as Adam's sin affected all of mankind and corrupted and was brought under the same sentence of death, Adam turns our attention toward the sin of the human race, right? Jesus Christ turns our attention to life and righteousness. What about King David? We were talking about this in men's breakfast yesterday. King David, did he get what he deserved? Yes, sometimes, but not really completely. King David, the one story that I'm thinking about is when he had all the power. He saw Bathsheba. He had Bathsheba's husband killed. What happened to him? He was confronted by Nathan, the prophet. He was granted forgiveness when he repented. His life was preserved, and his kingship went on. So, grace doesn't erase consequences, but it does restore relationships. Did Jonah get what he deserved? He ran away from God. He disobeyed outright, went in the opposite direction he was told to go by God. He deserved rejection. He deserved replacement. He deserved God's divine anger. But instead, God rescued him from the sea, gave him a second chance, taught him compassion. So Jonah is a story of God's patience with stubborn people. What about the Israelites in the desert? What do? They complained, they doubted, they rebelled. They built a golden calf. Did they get what they deserved? God continued to feed them. He guided them with the cloud and the fire. He kept his covenant. They did not earn his faithfulness. He gave it to them anyway. The woman called in adultery. She was caught in the very act and legally deserved stoning. Jesus protected her from condemnation, exposed the hypocrisy of the accusers, and sent her away with dignity and a call to change. So what I was talking about, spades, there's one spade that beats every single thing in the deck, and that's the Ace of Spades. So we're going to say that mercy is the Ace of Spades, and it triumphs over judgment. So a couple of weeks ago, we finished our series on John, and we read about Peter. Peter, walk with Jesus, best friends, I'll do anything for you. We know he denied him three times. And did Peter get what he deserved? He deserved rejection. He deserved loss of leadership. He deserved shame. And what did he get? God restored him with reaffirmations of love. God recommissioned him to be the shepherd of the church. And God used him powerfully on the day of Pentecost. So failure did not disqualify him. Grace transformed him. One more, the thief on the cross. We know that story. He deserved judgment, separation, condemnation. What were Jesus' words to him? He repented, and Jesus said, "Today you will be with me in paradise." So, if you make your bed, you have to lie in it. Yes, you have to face the consequences, but we all understand that we have received, because of repentance, we've received God's grace and redemption. So I wanted to go into one story a little bit more depth, and that is one of the, I think everybody loves the story because it's such a beautiful story. It's just a beautiful picture of God's love and power of redemption. And that is the story of the prodigal son. So I picked up this book not long ago, and it's by somebody that we quote around here quite often, Henry Nouwen. It's called The Return of the Prodigal Son. Henry Nouwen himself was a Dutch-born Catholic priest, professor, and pastor, and we've all heard of him. I love to read. He's one of these people that's like, man, I'd love to do, let's all get together and read a book together and discuss this, because this book was so rich and it went into such great imagery about, well, let me just back up a little bit. It all sort of happened with Nouwen, Richard Nouwen, what's his first name? Henry, I'll just call him Henry. So Henry was in, he was in France, okay? So it was 1983. Henry's in France and he's working at a home for disabled people. And he, while there, he sees a very prominent or famous portrait called The Prodigal Son. It's actually just a poster, a reprint of this picture called Rembrandt, who lived in the 1600s. He painted a picture called The Return of the Prodigal Son. So, like all of us, Rembrandt was trying to figure out life. And Henry Nouwen, he was trying to figure out life at that particular point. And when he saw that portrait, if you want to pull up on your phone and just, if you want to Google it, if you care to see the picture, I can't really show it to you here. But it's Rembrandt, the prodigal son, the portrait. And in it, Henry just says, that picture just totally makes me see me, myself as a prodigal son, because at that given time, Henry was sort of, I guess we would, in today's vernacular, we say he was burned out. He had been teaching at the universities in South and Central America, feeling quite lost. He'd wandered far and wide, met people of all sorts of lifestyles and convictions, and become a part of many movements. But at the end of it all, he said, I felt homeless and tired. So the word homeless is a word I'm going to be talking about a little bit. Where do you really feel at home? We sometimes say home is where the heart is. Well, where is the heart? The heart is really, if you're a Christian, you've known that feeling of, I know that I've received God's forgiveness and grace, and I know that my heart is with Him and my home is with Him. He's my protector. He's my shield. He's my everything. And yet, we know that, I know that feeling of God is with me, God is for me. But do we stay in that place? Usually not. We veer away. We sometimes leave home. We find ourselves in places where we're like, how did I get here? And God is always coming, calling us back home in true relationship, in good standing with Him. So if you'll just forgive me for reading just some excerpts, I don't like to be read to very much, but I can't do this justice without reading a few parts of this. Okay, thank you. I've been forgiven already. And I haven't even done it yet. So Henry felt like he felt he could really identify, he felt a real connection to the prodigal son. He said, I felt very deeply that I was the lost son and wanted to return as he did, to be embraced as he was, the prodigal son was. For a long time, I thought of myself as the prodigal son on his way home, anticipating the moment of being welcomed by my father. But then, unexpectedly, he had a friend of his who said, Henry, I don't think you're quite seeing the whole picture. And he was like, what are you talking about? Are you all getting more familiar with people that go to AI for friendships? It's like, I haven't done it yet, but I've seen, like, on social media, people are going to AI, and they're, like, telling them all their problems, and AI is just like your best friend, will tell you everything you want to know, everything that'll make you feel good, everything that he thinks, whatever itching ears you have, it'll scratch and make you feel good about whatever. But a real friend sometimes will tell you what you don't want to hear. And so this friend of his says, Henry, I don't see you as a prodigal son at all. I see you as the elder son. And I think we probably heard sermons about the elder son and his whole perspective and all that. But it just changed Henry's whole perspective. Like, elder son, how am I like the elder son? And then as he began to think about it and listen and really pray, he began to see, oh, I do see exactly what you're talking about now. So Rembrandt had, I'll tell you a little bit about his life, but let me tell you a little bit about Henry's life. Henry said he began to identify a little bit more with the older brother because Henry was the eldest child in his family. He had lived a very dutiful life. When he was 6 years old, he'd already decided he wanted to become a priest, never changed his mind, born, baptized, confirmed, ordained in the same church, and had always been obedient to his parents, teachers, bishops, never run away from home, never wasted time or money on sensual pursuits, never gotten lost in debauchery and drunkenness. It says, for my entire life, I've been quite responsible, traditional, and homebound. But with all of that, I may, in fact, have been just as lost as the younger son. I suddenly saw myself in a completely new way. I saw my jealousy, my anger, my touchiness, doggedness, sullenness, and most of all, my subtle self-righteousness. I saw how much of a complainer I was and how much of my thinking and feeling was ridden with resentment. And for a time, it became impossible for me to see how I could have ever thought of myself as the younger son when now he could so strongly see himself in the older brother. Now, Rembrandt, a little about him, early 1600s, biographers describe him as a proud young man, strongly convinced of his own genius and eager to explore everything the world had to offer, an extrovert who loved luxury and is quite insensitive to those around him. There's no doubt that Rembrandt's main concern was money. He made a lot, he spent a lot, he lost a lot. If you look at the self-portraits that he painted during his late 20s and his early 30s, you could see that he was a man that was hungry for fame and adulation. He has these elaborate collars, and I don't know if you've seen pictures of him, but he was like very impressed with himself. But during his latter years, well, let me tell you a little about his personal tragedies. He had a rough life. He, like the prodigal son, he experienced a lot of loss. He lost his first son, his first daughter, 1638. His second daughter, 1640. His wife died, 1642. He's left behind with a 9-month-old son named Titus. Titus had a little nanny, and Rembrandt and the nanny became involved, and then the nanny sued him, and she ended up in a mental institution. And anyway, during these years, Rembrandt's popularity as a painter plummeted. His financial problems were so severe that in 1656, he is declared insolvent and asked for the right to sign over all his property and effects for the benefit of his creditors just to avoid bankruptcy. So Rembrandt himself dies in 1669 as a poor and lonely man. So this is Henry saying, Henry's sort of comparing his life to Rembrandt. They're not exactly, it's not exactly parallel, but he says, I see similarities. He said, as I look at the prodigal son, this is him looking at the actual portrait. Henry says, as I look at the prodigal son kneeling before his father, and pressing his face against his chest, I cannot but see that there was once a self-confident and venerated artist who had come to the painful realization that all the glory he had gathered for himself proved to be vain glory. So the prodigal son, the return of the prodigal son, when you think about the return, you have to let's back a little bit and talk about the leaving. You think about the leaving of the prodigal son. When he left his home, he was so arrogant. What did he say to his father? Let me have the share of the estate that will come to me. There's this guy, he's dead now, but he lived in the United States, but his name was Kenneth Bailey. He tried to really understand what that would have looked like in that day. And so this guy, Kenneth Bailey, he said over 15 years, he lived in Europe. He lived all over Africa and Asia. And this guy says, for 15 years, I've been asking people of all walks of life around Morocco, India, Turkey, Sudan, about the implications of the son's request for his inheritance while his father is still living. The answer has always been emphatically the same. The conversation sounds something like this. This guy was asked somebody in the village, has anyone ever made a request in your village? Never. Could anyone ever make such a request? Impossible. If anyone ever did, what would happen? His father would beat him, of course. Why? This request means he wants his father to die. So the fact that this young son was so arrogant that he would even ask his father was such an insult to him. But we know the rest of that story too, right? When the younger son found himself in squalor and realizing the mistakes that he had made, and he returned home. He returned home, and his father welcomed him and had a party, and the coming back home again, the coming home again. This is the part that I thought was interesting. I would have never thought of this, but Henry Nouwen says, leaving home is more than a historical event bound by time and space. It is a denial of the spiritual reality that I belong to God with every part of my being, that God holds me safe in an internal embrace, and that I am indeed carved in the palms of God's hand and hidden in their shadows. Leaving home means ignoring the truth that God has fashioned me in secret, molded me in the depths of the earth, and knitted me together in my mother's womb. And I'm just going to read this one more thing. Leaving home is living as though I do not yet have a home, and I must look far and wide to find one. Home is the center of my being, where I can hear the voice that says, you are my beloved, on you my favor rest. So I've heard that voice, I think you've heard that voice, and yet we, in some way, like the prodigal, we veer away from that place of being at home with God, and we find ourselves in sometimes all types of situations. All right, if I go too long, y'all do this, because I don't know if I can keep up with time that much. All right, I've got a little bit more time. So, he squandered his money in a life of debauchery, filled himself with a husk of pigs they were eating. But then this is probably one of the best parts of the whole story. Then he came to his senses, and he said, we know sort of what he said, I won't even paraphrase it. He came to his senses. So what happened to the son in the distant country? Aside from the material and physical consequences, what were the inner consequences of the son's leaving home? The sequence of events is quite predictable. The farther I run away from the place God dwells, the less I am able to hear the voice that calls me the beloved. And the less I hear that voice, the more entangled I become in the manipulations and the power games of the world. So sometimes this story, instead of being called the prodigal son, it could also be called the parable of the lost sons. And I won't go too much into the older son, but I did tell you that Henry related more with the older son. So this is what Henry said. It's hard for me to conceive that this bitter, resentful, angry man might be closer to me in a spiritual way than the lustful younger brother. Yet the more I think about the elder son, the more I recognize myself in him. As the eldest son in my own family, I know well what it feels like to have to be the model son. I said I was going to stop reading, didn't I? But here I'm still reading. The lostness of the elder son, however, is harder to identify. It's like we know what happened to the younger son. He was forgiven. He was welcomed home. His father was thrilled to have him back. But this Bible account is not a fairy tale. And so we don't get the same story. We don't really know what happened to the elder son. We don't know if he found repentance, if he found his way back into the father's embrace. We don't know that. He did all the right things. He was obedient, dutiful, law-abiding, hardworking. People respected him, admired him, praised him, considered him the model son. Outwardly, the elder son was faultless. But when confronted by his father's joy at the return of his younger brother, a dark power erupts in him and boils to the surface. Suddenly, there becomes glaringly visible, a resentful, proud, unkind, selfish person, one that had remained deeply hidden, even though it had been growing stronger and more powerful over the years. So Henry says, looking deeply into myself and then around at the lives of other people, I wonder which does more damage, lust or resentment. I'm going to read this last thing, I promise. When I listened carefully to the words which the elder son attacks his father, self-righteous, self-pitying, jealous words, I hear a deeper complaint. The elder son is like, what about me? It is a complaint that comes from a heart that has never received, feels like it has never received what it was due. It is the complaint expressed in countless subtle and not so subtle ways, forming a bedrock of human resentment. It's as if the complaint that cries out, I tried so hard, I worked so long, I did so much, and still I've not received what the others get so easily. Why do people not thank me, not invite me, not want to be with me, not honor me? Why do they pay so much attention to those who take life so easily and so casually? So complaining, and I've complained, don't we all find ourselves that way sometimes? I think we can all relate to a certain extent. The elder son's inability to share in the joy of his father becomes quite understandable. When he came home from the fields, he heard music and dancing. He knew that there was joy in the household. Immediately, he became suspicious. Once the self-rejecting compliant has formed in us, we lose our spontaneity to the extent that even joy can no longer evoke joy within us. All right. I'm going to, as Nancy Penn says, when you get to the end, you got to land the plane and be done with this. So we'll land the plane here and just say this. I can't relate to some of the Bible accounts that I read because I'm not a king that has the power to, like, have somebody killed because I'm lusting after his wife. I don't know what it's like to be in the belly of a whale or a big fish for 3 days. I can't relate to some of these Bible stories that we read about. But I do know the concept of not getting what I deserve. I don't know if you've ever had this, like when you're like, you know, you're off. Your relationship with God is just not where it's supposed to be. You're not at home with Him, that place where you know that you know that you know. You're just not there, and you're like, I've wandered off yet again. You think about a time in your life. I don't know for you. It was me. It was like a one-time epiphany when I understood God's grace and love and mercy for me. For others, it's like a period of time where it's just more of a realization over, you know, a period of time they begin to understand that, you know, I know that God's loved me and He saved me from my sins and I found my home and my identity in Him. So I'm going to ask you to do something with me that's a little unusual here, but I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. And I'm going to just, this can be sort of something that has happened in your past where you're not right with God and you have this either, it could be like an internal dialogue that you're having with yourself in your own mind. Or it could be like sort of an internal dialogue, or maybe it's maybe a little bit of a prayer, or maybe a little bit of a both. And you say to yourself or to God, God, I've messed up again. I keep saying I'm your disciple, but I've sinned again. And when I find myself sinning, I feel like I've traded gold for dust. I'm so disappointed in myself, and I know you must be too. And if you're in a place where you have any ability to clearly remember the character of God, you might hear Him say, do you think your sin is stronger than my mercy? And I will say, but God, I have failed you again. And He says, I knew that you would fail, and I still chose you. It's not your weakness that offends me. It's your pride that keeps you from healing. And I say, but God, how many times do I have to fall to the same sin? And He'll say, you're asking the wrong question. How many times will I catch you when you fall? How long will I wait at your door praying for you? But I don't deserve this. I say you do, because you are mine. So God's love and mercy are greater than our mistakes. If I got what I deserved, I would not be here today. I would not have the assurance that God loves me in spite of my ongoing failures. So the next time you hear the phrase, he made his bed, now he can lie in it, we know that that's partly true. We do have to reap the consequences of bad choices and mistakes. But, and I'll end with this last Bible verse, it's Romans 5, 8. And this first verb is in present tense. God demonstrates his own love for us. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And why did he do that? Because we serve a God of enduring love and grace. And so as we reflect on our own lives and what our relationship with this God right now, I can totally relate to the idea of, I feel so at peace at home. I feel like, you know, you read in the Old Testament about the cleft of his rock. I feel like I'm in a safe place. I feel like if there's a tornado going on around me or whatever, my mother is like got her arm around me and I'm safe because she's got my back. She's going to take care of everything. And we know that humans can't always do that, but God can.